from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
And good evening, everyone. If you've been following some of the high-profile cases that we've been covering here on Scared Monkeys, you'll know the Madeleine McCann case and, of course, the American college student Amanda Marie Knox, who is accused of her and her Italian boyfriend of murdering their British roommate, a young British girl who's a college roommate of Knox's. And I've been rather impressed with some of the coverage that I've seen, especially on NBC. And in fact, I'd love to have my next guest, frequent flyer miles, Clint Van Zandt, is here. Of course, he's a retired FBI agent, author, and president of Van Zandt Associates. And he's been to Portugal and Italy covering these cases. And I thought I'd bring him on tonight to talk about them. Hi, Clint.
Hey, good evening, Dana.
Happy New Year. I haven't talked to you for a while.
Thank you to you and your listeners.
I'd love to have your frequent flyer miles. You've been all over the place there, bud. Let's talk about McCann. In fact, the Madeleine McCann story has been in the news today somewhat, that the Portuguese police say they're ready to file charges against the parents. Let's get your comment about that and then get into the investigation.
You know, there's this terrible comment made about lawyers sometimes where it's a bad joke. And the joke goes, you know, how do you know if a lawyer's lying? His lips are moving. And you and I know that, you know, 99% of lawyers, men and women, are hardworking people who are just, you know, trying to do right by their client. But in the case of the Portuguese cops and the Portuguese media, you know, what I found over there, Dana, is the police... Number one, they did a horrible. They did a forensic investigation at the crime scene, probably equal to that done at the JonBenet Ramsey murder house the day that that young child was found dead. I mean, we could spend the next half an hour talking about everything the cops screwed up when they tried to do their FCI examination. Just one thing, for example, you know how you take Ziploc bags and you're gathering physical evidence and putting that in the bags. Well, inside some of the bags, they found cigarette ash.
Jeez.
Determined that wasn't from the crime scene. It was a cigarette hanging from the mouth of one of the cops, and the ash dropped in the bag and contaminated the evidence. So, you know, from the get-go, that case was horribly handled. From the response, the physical response, first officers on the scene, everything that was done on that thing screwed it up. And my opinion, you know, and I'm pretty quick to give you that, but my gut opinion is that the Portuguese police were way over their head on this. Now, you know, you got to say they, like the Boulder, Colorado Police Department, are not used to working homicide cases or even missing persons cases that involve young children. And instead of perhaps very quickly reaching out both departments and getting help, they attempted to do it themselves, and they really muddled this thing up. And I think when I've looked at this thing and I've talked to the people involved and I've looked at the investigation ever since young Madeleine went missing that terrible night, my gut opinion right now is that it appears, and you know, I could be dead wrong. I mean, you and I know that statistically you always have to look at parents when you have a missing or dead child, because of course they're the ones closest to the child, and then you have to move away from that. In this case, the Portuguese police originally considered a unknown stalker, an unidentified offender, as the possible kidnapper. Then they considered this British expat, Robert Murat, who was in the lived right next door to the apartment complex where this family, Madeleine McCann's family, was vacationing. Then they circled all the way around to the family again. And I think they latched on to the mother and father. I mean, this is a Ken and Barbie couple, both doctors, good-looking, got their act together, and have lost one of their three precious children. And my feeling, and I think the feeling of a lot of people who looked at this case, is that the Portuguese police screwed up the case. They weren't able to close it by investigation. They latched on to the parents as the logical suspects. They threatened, because the parents stayed in Portugal and continue to put the heat, international heat, more media attention on this missing person case than I think any other missing person case in the world. So much media attention was there that I think the Portuguese police wanted to get these people out of the country. They told Madeline's mother that they were going to arrest her and they were going to seize her other two children and put them in homes for homeless children or something.
Right.
So the parents scooped up their kids, ran from Portugal, left the country. I think the Portuguese police dusted off their hands and said, well, you know, we've got them out. The tourist industry is alive and well. And now we've got the Portuguese police again suggesting that they went from a unidentified offender who was allegedly seen carrying a child back to the parents being the primary suspects again.
You know, when you look at this case and the parallels to, like you say, Jean-Benet Ramsey, as far as incompetence goes, Aruba, and the high-profileness of them, and we see so much in the media, especially in this case. In fact, they're the private detectives or whatever have been in the media here recently saying that they believe that Madeline is alive and she is wherever.
And they're making $50,000 a month and promising that they're going to rescue her every month. And now here we are 3 or 4 months into the PI's work in the case. You know, they've made about $200,000 and they keep telling us that her rescue is just around the corner.
And that's the part that must, both as a law enforcement officer and a journalist, it must just drive you around the bend to see this sort of circus that follows a case like this. When you look at Investigative 101 and you and I sit down and talk about it, the mistakes were made right from the beginning, yet there's so much of a media circus going on about it, but it's not bringing this little girl back or getting answers. Your thoughts?
You know, there's, I guess, an analogy like a train going down a set of tracks. And that train, every so often, if it's burning coal, needs to stop and pick up a load of coal before it keeps on chugging away. If that train neglects to stop, doesn't get that, heads on down the track again, it's going to get so far, there's going to be no way it can back up. It is not going to be able to come back. It's not going to be able to recreate what it should have done. And law enforcement investigations are like that. I mean, you know, as an FBI agent for 25 years, I mean, I screwed up. The FBI screwed up. I mean, that happens. It's human nature. But what you've got to do is take your hits, you know. You've got to say, hey, we made a mistake. And, you know, like I was at Waco. We made mistakes at Waco. The Branch Davidians all didn't need to die in the way they did. Notwithstanding they set the fire, that didn't have to happen. It was a mistake. I was there, and, I mean, I think about that every day, how many years we are later. So, I mean, I've lived through those terrible mistakes that we make individually and corporately. But when you turn around and when you, in this case, blame the parents,
right,
suggesting that the parents had something to do with this without physical evidence. I mean, we're 4 or 5 months into the police saying, well, we found DNA evidence in the apartment, or we found a human bodily fluid in the back of a car that the McCanns rented 25 days after Madeline disappeared, and we found her body fluid in there. Well, maybe we didn't. Well, maybe it was body fluid consistent with her other two siblings. Well, maybe it wasn't. Dana, it either is or it ain't. You know, DNA doesn't give you a choice. You either have got a match, just like latent fingerprints, or you don't have a match. And when I see this flip-flopping on the part of the police, and then when I see the police floating stories out to the media that they can't back up with physical evidence, and then someone told me in Portugal a story that they saw 3 or 4 members of the Portuguese media sitting around a table in a restaurant discussing the case, deciding what story they were going to make up and run in the paper the next day just to see what type of attention they could get. I mean, you know, you want to run from a place like that. I tell you what, no Portuguese vacations in my future, I guarantee you.
I was just going to say, how popular are you there? Well, you know, when you look at these stories, and we've talked about them, these foreign jurisdictions, there's some cases up here where it's a Canadian couple were murdered in Mexico, again, Aruba, Portugal, you name it, and they rush to judgment. If I may, to bring some sort of conclusion, obviously, or your thoughts, is this what's going on here? They need to get themselves out of the media and try and bring an answer to this, even though they're absolutely wrong.
Well, you know, our problem is the media is just everywhere. You know, here I am part of it, you know, but the media is 24/7. I mean, there was a time when I was a kid, we had three networks in America, NBC, ABC, and CBS.
Yeah.
We would get a half hour of local news, a half hour of world news at night, and that was it. And now, like, you know, my network, NBC, or especially MSNBC, I mean, you are getting news 24/7, and they have to have new news and new feeds because they can't take one story and run it time and time again. They have to have a new spin to it. So whether it's cable television, whether it's tabloid newspaper, whether it's actual legitimate newspaper, whether it's radio, these stories are being turned over and over again, and it's like the paparazzi, you know, of media. They've got to be out there, they've got to be getting pictures, they've got to be getting stories. And you know, I mean, all the time you and I had on the street as investigators, there was an old story in a television series in America. It was called Get Smart.
Yeah.
You had Maxwell Smart, and they had this cone of silence, you know, this plastic dome that would come down over people where they could, you know, supposedly talk without being overheard. Where you wanted to put something like that over a case. You want to put a cone of silence and say, media, stay out. Let the cops get in there, do their job, solve the case. Let's not try the case before the public. Let's try it before a jury. Let's not try it in the media. And, I mean, at least in the United States, we've lost that. And I think that's a real shame.
Absolutely. Let's go from that case to a case where it appears to be a whole bunch of evidence, DNA evidence, you name it. A young, pretty American college student, Amanda Knox, involved rough sex, a murder of a roommate, foreign governments, you name it. It seems to be an absolute different parallel to the McCann case, to this case, where it looks like the police have done their job, or am I wrong?
These cops have done an awful good job. I mean, I spent a week in Italy. I spent a couple of days in Rome with the Italian CSI, wonderful organization, great facilities, learned investigators, the head of their whole CSI unit, a bright, articulate guy. I was up at the crime scene, which is about 100 miles north of Italy. I spent the better part of a week there talking to people at the scene, looking at the crime scene, getting to know the individuals involved. And as your listeners may recall, this story deals with the murder of a British college student, a young woman by the name of Meredith Kircher.
Right.
She lived in this idyllic college town, I say about 100 miles north of Rome. Beautiful town up on a hill overlooking. I mean, it's what you picture Italy as being. And she had two Italian roommates who were working for a law firm and going to school. And they needed a fourth roommate. And they took in a girl from America who came over, a young woman by the name of Amanda Knox in her early 20s, who was in her junior year of college. So they took her in as the fourth roommate. And as the story progressed, Knox had only been there about a month. It was Halloween night. Everybody was out and about dressed in vampires. This is a big college, international college environment. So, you know, a lot of kids having fun. A lot of kids there to drink. A lot of kids there just to have relationships with others. A lot of kids there to study. So it ran the gamut. But the next day, Meredith Kircher, the victim, she returns to her apartment later that evening, and lo and behold, shortly thereafter, the next morning, she's found with a knife has been run through her throat from the left side, of her, excuse me, from the right side of her neck all the way through, and it passed through, didn't cut the carotid artery, came through the left side. And her clothes had been ripped off, her pants, her shirt, her bra had been ripped off. There was evidence of a probable sexual assault that had taken place on her. And then she died, died obviously of the wound, but instead of her throat cut and died or bleeding to death, she choked on her own blood. And that's what killed that young woman. And my only problem with the investigation, when I got in there and the cops were looking at Amanda Knox, the American roommate who was there, they're looking at Amanda's boyfriend, Rafael Solicito, who's a 23-year-old Italian. Amanda and her boyfriend, all they thought about was drugs, sex, and rock and roll. That's what they were there for. Then their drug connection was a guy from the Ivory Coast, a guy by the name of Rudy Gurdy, who had, after the murder, fled to Germany and had been extradited back. Rudy allegedly says, yeah, I was in the house. I had consensual sex with Meredith Kircher, the victim. Then I happened to go to the bathroom because I had a bad taco that day or something. I'm sitting in the restroom. I've got my iPod. I'm listening to tunes. I don't hear any commotion. I go out of the bathroom, and there, you know, it's almost like, remember the old movie, The Fugitive? You've got this mysterious one-armed man. Well, all of a sudden, Rudy, the drug dealer who comes out, allegedly says, I see this guy come running down the hall of the house. He's wielding a knife. I fight him. He stabs me in the hand. He runs from the house with one other person. Then Rudy, the drug dealer, runs down the hall, goes into the bedroom where he had had a relationship, allegedly, with Meredith. He finds her stabbed. She's bleeding to death. He says he makes a valiant effort to save her. Of course, he doesn't dial the Italian equivalent of 911. That's not his valiant effort. Then he leaves, goes drinking for the rest of the night, and manages to go to Germany, where he's extradited back. Well, as the story progresses, Amanda Knox says first, yes, I was there. It was a guy who runs a bar that I work at, Patrick Lumumba. He wanted to have relations with Meredith. He came there that night. He went in and forced himself on her. I heard screams and yells and shouts. I covered my ears. I couldn't stand it. Well, then when Lumumba's alibi, hey, I was working at the bar and here's the bill showing where I had rung up purchases, showed he couldn't have done it, then Amanda says, well, you know, maybe it wasn't. Maybe I was just in a drug fog. And now she's told a story, well, maybe my boyfriend and I went back to his apartment, went to bed, and maybe he got up in the middle of the night, he went over and stabbed Meredith, and then he came back and he put the knife in my hand when I was asleep, therefore accounting for the victim's DNA on the tip of the blood, DNA on the handle. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what she was smoking. That was bad stuff.
Yeah, that fog lasted a long time. But
that's it. That fog came in San Francisco and never dissipated.
What's the status of that case now? Italian law, a preliminary hearing, a trial, what have you heard?
Yeah, well, the status right now, talking to the investigators, I talked to the lead detective, I talked to the prosecutor, and I spent a significant amount of time going over the forensic evidence. And the police initially thought they had a four-way sex game that had gone terribly bad, with people just kind of going over the element. You know, they thought everybody, to include the victim, had participated in this four-way wrestling match on the floor or whatever. But as it turns out, of course, of the four, Amanda Knox, Rafael Solicito, her boyfriend, Rudy, the drug dealer, and Meredith, the victim, Meredith was the only one who didn't have drug or alcohol in her system. She was the one who had her clothes ripped off. So, you know, as I told the cops, I said, this was not a sex game gone bad. This was a brutal sexual assault. What we found out is that Meredith had withdrawn about the equivalent to about $350, $400 from an ATM that day, had the money in her apartment that she was going to use to pay her rent. Now there's a potential theory that Amanda and her boyfriend needed money to pay for the drugs. They came in the apartment. They found Meredith's money. Rudy came. They were given Rudy the money to pay for the drugs. Meredith came in. And then everything else that happened was a cover-up for the robbery, so they wouldn't be caught in this terrible robbery. I mean, you know, you're going to kill somebody over $350. I mean, I've seen guys kill each other over, you know, the last piece of chicken in a box of Kentucky Fried Chicken. So $350 is a lot compared to that. Well, Dana, they've got over 200 organic pieces of physical evidence in this case that CSI has collected. They can put Amanda Knox there the night it happened. They can put her blood mixed with the blood of the victim. They can put Amanda's boyfriend, Raphael, at the crime scene because we have his tennis shoe print in the victim's blood in the bedroom. We can put Rudy Grudy, the drug dealer who acknowledged that he had sexual contact with her. We have a pillow that was found under the victim's body that has his bloody handprint, obviously the victim's blood, on that pillow. So forensically, we can put all three of these people who are now in custody with the Italians. They have 1 year before they have to charge anyone. What a way to, you know, work a case. They can take someone, they can put you in jail, not on probable cause, but reasonable suspicion, and they can hold you for a year before they formally charge you. And then if you are convicted of murder, it is a guaranteed flat 21 years. No plea bargaining, no this, no that, no anything else. You go into the slammer for 21 years for homicide. So, you know, at this particular point, I think the cops feel within these three suspects they have in jail, they have their killer. They haven't put the story together yet. But as you and I know, since they've got three people in jail, they're going to need to flip somebody and get them to testify. And look, they're in Italy. Rafael Solicito is the boyfriend. He's an Italian. His father is a very wealthy Italian doctor. I would, you know, as I watch this case, I would bet that when it comes, let's make a deal time, he's the one that's going to get the deal. And the Ivory Coast drug dealer, Rudy, and the American ditzy student, Amanda, are going to take a bad fall on this one.
Well, it's certainly a jurisdiction that others could learn from. Clint, it's always a pleasure having you on.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir.
Bye now.
That's Clint Van Zandt talking about the Madeleine McCann case and the Amanda Marie Knox case. Two different parallels when it comes to investigations. I sat down earlier today with Brooke Hart. He's the attorney for Dwayne Doug Chapman and Tim Chapman to get his side of what's going on now with Doug the Bounty Hunter and a most recent arrest of Tim Chapman, who's not related to Dwayne, but Dwayne calls him young blood, his blood brother. It just seems like when it rains, it pours for the bounty hunters down in Hawaii. And here's what Brooke Hart had to say earlier today. We're back. Just when you think things have calmed down a little bit for Dwayne Doug Chapman, his family, and his co-workers, we should say, we see a story in the news here the other day about Tim Chapman, no relation, although Dwayne calls him his brother. They're blood brothers, I guess we should say. When you see reports like this and you hear reports of mall security officers and then the tabloids jump on it right away, I thought I'd go right to the source. And on the line with me is Brooke Hart, who is Tim Chapman's attorney, to find out just what's going on. Hi, Brooke.
How are you?
I'm fine. Nice to have you
back.
Happy
New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Nice to have you back on the show. It seems like when it rains, it pours for you guys. Things were calming down a little bit, and all of a sudden, bang, the tabloid news agencies pick up on a story. Tell us about what's going on here.
Well, Mexico case involving Dwayne seemed to have been resolved when the U.S. District Court Magistrate Judge Barry Curran dismissed the extradition charges in November, and we thought that matters had come to kind of a rest. But recently, there was another incident that had nothing to do with the bounty hunter or bounty hunter business that involved Tim on January 3rd, when Tim was in the area of Ala Moana Center, which is a large shopping center in Honolulu, and was going there to return a Christmas gift that he received, but he was also drinking a glass of orange juice. Mm-hmm. And as he approached the center, the orange juice cup spilled, fell out of his hand, actually, and all the orange juice fell in his lap.
Mm-hmm.
So he pulled into a parking lot next to a bank that was closed, where he expected he would have privacy. He had some clean pants in the car, and he got into the back of his truck, which has windows that are heavily tinted on both sides and the rear, and was in the process of taking off his wet pants and getting ready to put on his dry pants when what turned out to be security guards came up to the car and demanded that he get out. Embarrassed by this incident and somewhat overly excited and panicked, instead of getting out of the car, he drove away. To do so, he had to drive over a 3-inch curb, but he has a large truck, so he drove over the curb and drove away. And out of this, the security guards, and I haven't seen the reports yet, complained that they were terroristically threatened when Tim drove past them and off the sidewalk and away. I don't know exactly where they were. He says that they were standing next to and behind the vehicle. He went forward in the vehicle, certain not to hurt anybody or even frighten anybody. But he drove away. So he was investigated. They recognized him. Obviously, many people do.
Sure.
And went to his home to, I guess, arrest him. He wasn't there. He's had some issues with his wife in the last few months, so he's been spending a lot of time at either friends' houses or in his car.
Right.
And then I was called the next morning, and I had him turned in, and bail was posted, and he's facing a charge of terroristic threatening as we speak.
Yeah.
Interestingly, he was not charged with indecent exposure, but the prosecutors have an option to do that, and they might tack that on, although frankly the circumstances in which he was changing his pants suggest to the reasonable individual that no one was around to be affronted if, in the course of changing his pants, they happened to peep into his car and look into the back in the area of the tinted windows.
Well, I think you answered a bunch of questions already. One would say, why would he have clothes in his vehicle? Well, if he's living in his vehicle because of issues that are only private to him and his wife, that's understandable. And I myself have seen the show where they get into a scuffle or a fight or something, or they use mace and they end up having to change their clothing. I've seen them do that and seen him carry his clothing. I got one question, Brooke. These mall security guards, are they actual law enforcement officers? Would Tim
no,
have...
No, they're not. That's, I think, an important point. They have authority in the mall to enforce whatever rules apply to people who are visiting the mall. It's private property, but I don't believe that they have any legal authority to order a person out of his car. So I think Tim might have done well to have stopped and tried to explain, but, he's trying to avoid the embarrassment of a public incident. And
exactly.
Just left the area.
Exactly. And when you're in the public and there's been as much negativity towards the bounty hunter crew, so to speak, I don't blame him, so to speak, panicking and maybe trying to get the heck out of there. What's Tim doing now? Is he okay? That's an important question.
He's okay. He was they processed him efficiently. He was released on bond, and he's not imprisoned, and we're going to court for the initial appearance on Wednesday.
Now, I'm not sure what you can comment on as far as the, if there was a group of people, a family with Dwayne as the leader that have gone through more strife, more trouble, more heartache than this group. I don't know what has, and these people are always able to come back and rebound. How are Dwayne and Beth doing, and what can you tell us about what's happening with him?
Well, I don't think I'm free to comment on that, except to say, understandably, given the status of their television program, they're understandably very concerned about this. The incident with Tim changing his wet pants in a parking lot in a way that he thought he had privacy had nothing to do with the program or
exactly
any aspect of the history of what's gone on over the past year. But I'm sure that Beth and Dwayne are quite concerned about Tim and care deeply about his welfare.
Can you comment on the status of A&E and the show, or do you know?
I don't think I'm at liberty to do that, and as far as I know is what has been published throughout the media, and that the show is on suspension, and A&E will be making decisions about what to do about it in the future, but I don't have any other information.
Well, you and I have talked about this before. Dwayne Chapman is probably one of the most sincere people that you'll ever meet, and he has gone above and beyond to show his sincerity. Do you see a rebound for Tim Chapman, who I consider to be just as sincere? When you see him, the persona on TV, I see that as the persona off the air, too. Is it just as a decent guy who looks like he made a dumb mistake?
Well, that's been my experience with him over the years, and I think that's precisely what happened. You know, one media source, the Honolulu Advertiser newspaper, treated this matter with the right perspective. There was a very short three-page discussion of the incident, and that was it. It wasn't a headline. It wasn't an international story. And, you know, it could happen to anyone.
Absolutely.
All of us go to the beach over here and change our clothes from time to time and think we have privacy. Often change in our cars. I know I can't keep clean clothes in my car. When I go swimming, I change into them and then go to work. So I think this matter has been blown out of proportion.
Absolutely, and when they come back as a terroristic threat, I think that's just it. Brookhart, it's always nice to have you. Say hi to Dwayne, Beth, and Tim for me. And
I will, Dana. Thank you very much.
Wish them my best. Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Brookhart, attorney for Dog Chapman, Tim Chapman. And it just, you know, when it rains, it pours for these guys. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. Have you been following the train wreck of Britney Spears? You know, we've talked about it many times on the program here. Different aspects of what she's been going through, the paparazzi angle, all that sort of stuff. Anyway, most recently we've seen in the media, they call it in California, I believe, my guest can correct me, I've done some stories on this before, what they call a 5150, which is a mental health assessment where law enforcement, EMS, whoever, are dealing with someone who they think can't take care of themselves, and that person is then taken into custody, so to speak, and then taken in for an assessment. Usually it's a 72-hour hold. What I thought I'd do this evening to talk more about this and get the legal perspective as far as what's going on with Britney Spears, and more importantly, her children, is bring on Deputy District Attorney Robin Sachs from Los Angeles. She's always a great guest to have on. You see her on Larry King, and of course her webpage is robinsachs.com. Hi, Robin.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm great. Did I get that wrong? It's a 5150, isn't it?
That's correct. It's a Welfare Institutions Code 5150, and it is a 72. It's an initial 72-hour hold.
Now, I know cases like this that I've been involved in personally, and the mental health system, so to speak, and jurisdiction to jurisdiction, it depends on the facilities and doctors and whether or not they're able to do something for someone. A lot of the times, perps or subjects that you're dealing with will try and get out of going to jail by playing the role of being crazy. But in this case, this young gal actually needed some help. We're told she checked herself out before time. But from the perspective of the district attorney and district attorney's office, you as an advocate for children, here you see a mother who has young children who basically lost it. And obviously there was a decision the evening that they took her in that enough's enough. We got to do something for her.
Yes, I mean, I think that, first of all, when you have any situation where someone is a danger to themselves and their children, there's an obligation for the state to come in and say, listen, we need to do some sort of observation and take a look at the situation and ensure that the kids are, in fact, safe and make sure that she's not going to cause any harm to them or to herself.
Watching the coverage, and at times I do feel sorry for her and others in this limelight. Yes, they encourage it. Yes, they bring it on themselves somewhat. But the paparazzi swarming you. We see Britney Spears coverage in the media daily. It's almost to the point where it's sickening. Where the big picture is the children. There's a divorce hearing, all that sort of stuff, custody, that sort of thing going on. When you see the type of coverage you do, let's just say hypothetically you're dealing with a case something like this, but you can't seem to keep your case away from the media. 24/7 there's reporters, photographers, right down to the fact where the subject that you're dealing with, they've got her looking out the ambulance as they're taking her away. How do you deal with something like that? In Los Angeles, it must be difficult because there's media all over the place.
Well, she is a media spectacle, and it is difficult, there's no doubt, and I do feel badly for her that at a time where she's obviously in great crisis and where she's under a tremendous amount of scrutiny, it's just magnified even more with the media there. However, someone like Britney Spears has, you know, she's a public figure. She's inserted herself into the media for many, many years. And she's devoured the media for so many years. I've compared this case actually a little bit to Princess Diana, who went to great lengths to keep the media away from her children and to protect her children, even during the times of her own mental illness and her own crisis. And so I can't help to wonder how much is what happens to her part of the train wreck that seems to come accompanied with Britney herself.
You know, we see Dr. Phil involved in this now, and whether his intentions were ratings or to actually help this young girl, we don't know. It just seems like it goes from bad to worse, and one, the family must be concerned with this is her well-being, but the system itself in California, is there enough being done? Is a 72-hour hold actually a 72-hour hold? We're hearing that she actually checked herself out beforehand.
Well, it is supposed to be a 72-hour hold, and the person who is subject to the 72-hour hold is not, doesn't have any discretion on their own to make the determination if they wish to stay or not stay, unless it was a voluntary submission, which in this case it was not. As a matter of fact, after a 72-hour hold under California law, there is the ability to extend the hold if the circumstances warrant and be able to have hearings and other due process rights that come into play. I don't know if there was some sort of recommendation made that she was no longer a threat to herself, or if there was any voluntariness to the commitment. It's all speculative right now. Also, I kind of quarrel with you a little bit of what her parents' best interests are with the whole Dr. Phil thing, because I really don't know that I really think that her parents really ever have her best interest at heart. I mean, to allow or encourage Dr. Phil to be there, to agree to go on a television show, to, you know, Britney Spears' mom with regard to her younger sister going on the cover of a magazine dealing with the pregnancy of, you know, the 16-year-old sister. I mean, there's so many decisions that are so poor, it's hard for me to see that these people are really acting in any of their children's best interests.
Yeah, it seems like there's a big follow the money trail when it comes to these families, and you know, any PR is good PR, and it's, you know, it's difficult as a as an instructor both to you know, the sheriff's department, LAPD, and in your role as a prosecutor. When you train for this, and you train police officers in the type of investigations that you do, and the type of training that that officers get, young officers, older officers, there's always that grizzled old cop like me, the old flat foot that's out there wanting to get the job done, roll on to the next call, and let's cut the psychobabble crap, and we're not going to play games here, and you know, the old timer that's out there. And then you've got the younger, the compassionate officer that's wanting to analyze the situation and do whatever. What are you looking for from an officer when he comes to present a case to you? Not necessarily a mental health case like this, but it could very well be, because the two are tied in. But you're looking for, you know, observations. The thing I tell young officers is to keep your eyes and your ears open, and sometimes it's best just to keep your mouth shut. But that's old time thinking too. You got to ask questions. What do you look for?
Well, I think the first thing is that whatever anybody's personal beliefs are, whether old-timer, new-timer, compassionate or not compassionate, the idea is to have a neutral, objective person, detective officer, who is making observation and making observations that are going to be essential to what could turn into evidence gathering later on. The idea is, you know, one of the things that I train officers to do is that in their police reports, for example, when they take statements, to utilize quotes. Quotation marks are wonderful things. We all can say, surmise what someone said and put it into our own words, but it's so much more effective when you can actually use the actual words from a witness or a victim or any other observer, as opposed to just drawing our own conclusions and making summary of that. And the other thing is, you know, you never really know what may turn into evidence later on. And so when you really spend the time to get complete statements and look into everything, that is an essential aspect. I mean, in this Britney Spears thing, for example, I mean, you would want to make sure that the children were interviewed, the DCFS people were interviewed, any 911 call to tapes were taken, the statements that Britney herself may have made, what occurred before and after the visit that happened that turned into this spectacle, and so forth.
Is the media doing a good job, Robin, when it comes to these sorts of cases, the coverage that it's being, you know, that they're giving, or is it just, you know, this is kind of schlock media? We're going to tape everything, anything, and get it on the air. You know, how much did we see about her and her lousy driving and driving over the paparazzi's foot? You know, that got to be sickening after a while, but this is much more serious.
That's true. I mean, in one sense, you want to blame the media and go, you know, oh my God, I can't believe this is what's actually making our, you know, world news right now. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have to say, well, there is a consumer and a person out there and many people out there who thrive and are interested in this stuff. So the question is it schlock media or is it just our own schlock morals that just gravitate towards this crap?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like the more of this type of programming, the more type of reality programming that we see on TV, and the internet is phenomenal now as far as, you know, these poor guys, they can't do anything without getting a picture taken of them, and all of a sudden it shows up on TMZ or wherever. Their privacy is gone, and I guess you expect that a little bit, or should expect it a lot, as a celebrity. But again, you know, we see celebrity justice, so to speak, and I'm not coining in on that on the television show, but we see how it's handled, and nobody really has a lot of faith in it, especially when it comes to cases, criminal cases, and how much of an expensive lawyer you can buy. Is that a bad rap on the system?
Well, I think that it's kind of an interesting dichotomy that I think that happens with in terms of celebrity justice, because in one way, I think that celebrities, because they have much more of a financial ability to be able to hire lawyers that can devote them the much more time than, say, your average public defender or average defense attorney to a case, and the resources are much greater. But at the same time, because of the scrutiny, the judges, the juries, and everybody else involved in the case, that once a case gets to trial, it seems like they get the benefit of any doubt, and all of a sudden, you know, there is no such thing as reasonable doubt anymore.
And it's the whole fairness aspect and the public confidence aspect. You know, we've seen Robert Blake and O.J. and Phil Spector and you name it. O.J. will be coming up again, and whatever happens with a lot of these other cases. Let's go now to your office, the district attorney's office. How do you handle and your office handle cases like this? How do you get yourself, you know, you're doing great work, and I imagine the DA's office has a PR person, but you have to instill the public's confidence somewhat, because that's your jury pool.
That's true. I mean, I think what we do and what we strive to do is to really go to great lengths to try to treat every defendant as equally as possible. I mean, it's to say that it's, you know, completely an objective analysis on how a defendant is treated is not exactly true, because we have to look at everybody's background and circumstances and what have you in terms of fashioning pleas and how we handle a case. But the idea is that you don't want to have a disparity between how, you know, a celebrity is treated versus how somebody else is treated. A perfect example is in the Paris Hilton case. I mean, I thought that, and that was not my office that handled that was the Los Angeles City Attorney's office that handled that. I thought that she was treated a lot harsher than I'd seen a lot of other cases in the municipal courts handled, and I was supervising there for a while and was kind of surprised that they got so much time on a, you know, suspended license charge. So, you know, you want to make sure that there's no disparity, you know, either in favor or disfavoring celebrities. It's just not fair, and that's not what our job is.
Yeah, and yet the public see the sentences, the Nicole Richie's and the Paris Hilton's, and like you say, you thought it was more harsh, but a lot of the public will say, really, that's all she got for driving with a suspended license? And they hear the maximum, but yet when the minimums come through and how the system is, they get discouraged and think, well, you know, it's just a celebrity. They spent 8 hours in jail, or in this case, Paris Hilton spent a lot more, and I agree with you. Anyway, Robin Sachs, it's always a pleasure having you on the program. I appreciate it, and we'll be in touch soon.
Likewise, and love the program, and thank you.
Take care, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's L.A. County District Attorney, Deputy District Attorney, Robin Sachs. Speaking of controversial topics, Drew Peterson. We all know Drew Peterson, the former Bolingbrook, Illinois police sergeant. His wife, Stacy, is missing. A press report actually came out that someone has seen her in Kentucky and may even have a cell phone picture of her. There's the exhumation of a past wife and all the stuff. Some cable shows have Drew Peterson and his lawyer on as a guest. Some don't. Some complain that they can't get the lawyer to come on, etc., etc., etc. Well, what I thought I'd do this afternoon is sit down with someone involved with this case very closely. His name is Joel Brodsky. He is the lawyer for Drew Peterson, and get his take on the information that came out today as far as Stacy being seen in Kentucky and his thoughts on how this case is being handled. Here's what Joel had to say this afternoon. Okay, we're back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. If you've been following the case of Drew Peterson and the disappearance of Stacy Peterson, you'll know that the story has been, rode hard and talked about every different way that it could be. There was a report that came out today, actually, about a sighting of Stacy Peterson somewhere in Kentucky. Drew Peterson allegedly received a letter saying this. What I thought I'd do, instead of, talking about all the spin that we see on cable news shows, is go to Joel Brodsky, who is Drew Peterson's lawyer, invite him on the program and have him discuss this. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have you on the show. Now, there was a report that came out today about sighting in Kentucky. I know that you're probably limited what you can tell us, but go ahead. The microphone is yours.
Well, yeah, not that limited. Apparently, we received a letter. It was addressed to Joel Peterson. I guess they got Drew's first name wrong. at his home. He got back from vacation, so we don't know exactly when it was delivered, but it was postmarked December 29th. And it talks about a sighting that this person had of Stacy November 18th in a Macy's, or outside a Macy's store in Florence, Kentucky. The writer says that they actually went up and confronted Stacy, and that Stacy said in response to their confrontation, "Please don't ruin my life. I want to be left alone, please." And the writer then took a cell phone picture of Stacy, and Stacy ran off.
Have you confirmed that there is actually a cell phone picture?
No, I wish we could. We did not come with the envelope, and there was no return address. But when we receive, and I know that the findstacypeterson.com and I know the Illinois State Police receive anonymous tips, you know, almost, I mean, absolutely on a daily basis, sometimes many on a daily basis. We don't publicize every single one. As a matter of fact, this is only the second anonymous tip we've ever publicized. But just the fact that we have somebody who says they actually spoke with Stacy and took her picture, we felt that we should disclose it in the hopes of getting that person perhaps to come forward. Because if they do come forward and do have a picture of Stacy, that obviously will put an end to all this rigmarole that's going on, you know, in very short order. So we're hoping that the person will come forward.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, just before I let you go, and I appreciate you coming on at short notice, the media coverage of the story has, you know, is spun 360 degrees either way. Here we have a man who's trying to live his life, who's been inundated by the media, who allegations have been made against, who basically has only been able to defend himself with some rare media appearances that he's made. Nothing has been filed against him, to my knowledge. I want you to comment, if you could, Joel, about the media coverage. I know some of it has been just absolutely irrehensible as far as I'm concerned, and some of it has been fair, but where do you look at this, and how do you deal with this as an attorney with your client?
Yeah, as an attorney, it's truly unprecedented. I've never seen such kind of like lynch mob mentality that I've seen in some of the media. I think you have to differentiate. There's what I call the tabloid. Well, not even tabloid. We call it the infotainment media, the ones that take information and make it turn it into entertainment. They're relentless, absolutely relentless. And they're out there inserting themselves into the criminal justice system for profit, which I think is should concern everybody. Well, we have the legitimate media out there who's doing trying to do a decent job. What we have is a situation where I was, for example, in releasing this letter here today, we were criticized for releasing an anonymous source letter. But if you ever punch in, go to any web search engine and punch in anonymous Andrew Peterson, you'll find out that there have been literally hundreds of articles written about Drew that have been based on anonymous sources. It's very strange situation to have to defend somebody where there hasn't even been any evidence that a criminal act has been committed, let alone dealing with the who did it aspect of it. We don't have a crime, so the amount of attention given to it is very strange. And what I want to ask is that anybody who's looking at this case take a deep breath and ask themselves what admissible or what evidence, what actual hard evidence that has credibility to it is there in this case? And the answer obviously is none, because if there was any, my client would have been charged. And then ask yourself the next question is why is this been so much attention on Drew as opposed to other people out there? There's plenty of missing people.
Right.
But why Drew? Why a white suburban police officer wife
as opposed to many of the other people who are missing. And perhaps the answer to that question will tell us a lot about the society we live in.
We've covered this case here on the program and other cases for many, many years now. And my final question to you, sir, is when you see some of the coverage, and again, we're tagging the media somewhat tonight, and that's okay because I think it needs to be done. And you see some of the coverage, some hosts, some pundits, as they like to call themselves, some people on the street, so to speak, taking it into their own hands to do their own investigation. I know from, I'm assuming from a law enforcement perspective, they must be shaking their head saying, leave this alone, Dick Tracy, you're not. From a defense attorney perspective and a prosecutor perspective, there is a jury pool out there that if this ever does go to a jury, that some hosts have gone above and beyond to try and taint that jury any way they can. Am I wrong when I say that?
No, I don't think you're wrong. But to some extent, it's to Drew's favor. For example,
yeah.
Mark Furman works for as a consultant, for Fox News Channel. I can't be a licensed detective because he's a convicted perjurer. Is going around interviewing witnesses and trying to dig up evidence in the courthouse. And I'm going to have, if there ever is a jury in this case, which I really still don't think there ever will be, but if there ever was, you better believe that as a defense lawyer, I'm going to have a racially mixed jury, that I'm going to bring up his name every single point in time I can. And I think it's going to have an effect. And I'm sure the prosecution is worried about that and wished that he would just go back to Idaho and keep his mouth shut. It certainly cuts both ways. I know that certainly finding an unbiased jury is going to be impossible. And that's kind of troubling. My client has an absolute right to a jury trial, an unbiased jury trial. And I think for a profit motive, that right is being taken away from him.
Well, that's it's a system that we have, and it's the best system. And I think we can all agree that Stacey Peterson, if she is out there, needs to come forward, and we can put a stop to all of this.
Yeah, that would be our hope. I have two theories on that. Either she's very afraid to come forward because she's afraid of the consequences. The other theory we have is that perhaps she's left the country. Why this case has a lot of exposure inside the United States.
Right.
We've been in contact with people overseas, and it has very little play overseas. And it's not altogether probable that she could be in a place like Thailand or Australia and not even know that anybody's looking for her. These are possibilities. I'm not saying they're likelihoods, but certainly possibilities. But we want Stacey to, just to indicate that she's well somewhere, so we can put an end to this, and my client can go on and raise the kids and go on with his life.
Absolutely. We need the investigators to investigate and the media to report the facts and stop this detective work. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Joel Brodsky, attorney for Drew Peterson. We'll be right back. And that's it. Joel Brodsky is controversial, to say the least, but the point of the interview was to hopefully get the point across that we would like to see investigators investigate and bring an answer to this case. That's it for this evening. I want to thank all my guests for joining me. Remember, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can pick up the show live, listen to daily commentaries, pick up podcasts of past shows, and we'll be back Friday night, Friday, January 11th at 9 o'clock Eastern, with a whole new Dana Pretzer show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. So mark that on your calendars, Friday, January 11th at 9 o'clock Eastern. Well, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you then. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.